This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Chris Moyer about education of children in Africa. Chris, you're on the phone from Texas. Can you hear me all right?
I sure can, Steve. How are you?
Very good. How did you get from teaching architecture at the University of Illinois to being involved in the Rafiki Foundation that helps kids in Africa?
Well, that's one of God's plans, I guess. It's amazing to see how you are end up places if you just sort of make yourself available, as so to speak. I retired from the university in 1999, and we had gone to a Wycliffe-sponsored, it was a meeting of trying to get people to be involved in mission sort of things. And so we went to that, and lo and behold, we ended up in a little town down in Guatemala and helping some kids down there, and some churches there rebuild. And then shortly after that, I had been involved with Bible Study Fellowship, which I think a lot of folks here in town, there in Champaign-Urbana, have been part of. And I had attended a meeting down here in San Antonio and just happened to have dinner with the general director of Rafiki one day, and that's when it started.
And who was the general director at that time?
That's Rosemary Jensen.
She was the founder.
Yes, and she was the general director of Bible Study Fellowship for 20 years and was just retiring from that and going full-time into this Rafiki Foundation, which she had founded back in 1985. But anyway, she said, well, now, you know, you might be interested in something we're just about to embark on. You're a retired architect. We think we could use you in some way. And retirement was over. It was great from that point on, because she was just embarking on, the foundation was just embarking on building orphanages and teenage girls and boys centers all over Africa. And they had not started on that yet, but they were just about to. And so I was right there at the beginning, which was really exciting.
Where does the name Rafiki come from?
It's a Swahili name. It means friend. And that's pretty well known all over Africa, although there are lots of different languages around why they're all familiar with the term Rafiki.
So in what way can a retired architect be a friend to children in various countries in Africa through the Rafiki Foundation?
Well,
what do you actually do?
It's a great opportunity. I tell you, architects would just, many would just love to have the opportunity that was just put in my lap, and because we're ending up building 10 villages in 10 different countries in Africa. And so we got to be involved in the design of all the facilities that were in each of those villages. It initially just started out as a orphanage, and then adding the vulnerable teenager program. And one of the countries was Malawi, as a matter of fact. The government had given Rafiki a very large piece of property to build this. And as Rosemary was going home one time from Africa, she thought, how can I use this much acreage? I mean, I've got enough room there to build an entire village. And that's sort of the light went on. And from that point on, we really have self-contained villages that include, a typical full village would include 18 cottages, and each of those cottages would hold 10 children and a mother, and then using an assistant mother. That mother is a national, by the way, who would be the permanent mother to that. It's and that those children, some of them, most of them, are coming in as infants, and so they will only know her as their mother. And so anyway, of the 18 cottages, and of course you have the feeding facilities for that, and lots of dirty clothes. So one building is a laundry dining facility. And then once they become of school age, why, right there in the village, we'll have preschool and a primary school. So there's two more buildings. And then the kids have a way of getting sick now and then, so we have a little clinic that is hopefully we'll have a permanent doctor in each of those clinics, but at the moment some of them are just volunteer doctors that come over from the States and will be there for several weeks and will conduct clinics for the entire, actually, villages around there. And then, of course, we have our own staff that are essentially missionaries that will live on the site. So we've got four, five, six residences for them, everything from three-bedroom houses to duplexes. And then you have all the and then we have the Teenage Girls Center, which is a vocational day school, and the Teenage Boys Center. Those are fairly large buildings because they have so much going on in them in the classrooms. And
how many teenagers would there be in those centers?
Each semester we bring in 10 new teenagers, so until we have a total of 60 at any one time. And then that one group would graduate at the end of 3 years, and then another 10 would come in.
So I'm afraid I've lost count of how many buildings in each one of these villages you're talking about. You said that there
We're probably going to be talking about 30-some separate buildings on a full in a full campus. And I mentioned the housing, the cottages, the dining, the schools, the clinic, and the Boys and Girls Center. There's also a guest house for short-term missionaries that come over, again, from the States typically, to work there for 2 weeks to a month and help. And then lastly, we have what we call the Village Hall. It would be a large meeting hall, and it could be used for athletics. It would bring in the community from around. They could do musical performances and plays and things like that. So we have probably 10 different building types in each one. So there was a lot of drafting lead put down on these to start with.
Now your own training in architecture was at the University of Illinois, is that correct?
That's right, yes.
And did you actually have classes in how to design buildings using materials and workmanship in third world countries?
There was certainly some of that addressed, but I wouldn't say it was specific to that. I mean, you learned the principles of construction and how to put things together, and then that's one of the things I do when I go over there is to research what the local materials are that are used. For instance, in Kenya, as in down here in San Antonio, we're surrounded by stone quarries. So in Kenya, the buildings are made out of solid stone. They're cut stone. And then in Malawi, it's a more traditional field burn brick that they make right out in the open.
Sure.
And, they're kind of crude, but when you get them all together, they look pretty good. And then typically we will use concrete block that is plastered on both sides, so it makes a very nice, smooth, finished steel wall. So most of the materials we have are pretty substantial, and we are really trying to have these villages set a standard for construction around there to show that, you know, there can be really good quality construction that will last a long time they can be proud of.
Now, these villages that you build for the teenagers, for the orphans, are they near other villages? Are they near urban areas? Are they completely out in the country?
Well, typically they're out in the away from the dense urban areas, but we do try to locate them fairly close to the capital in most cases of the country, and that's for a lot of reasons. For one thing, that's where a lot of orphans and vulnerable teenagers are. It's also a source of, you know, the equipment and materials we need. And we have to go in and out quite a bit, and so we can get to, you know, to an international airport usually within a reasonable amount of time. But so they're on the outskirts in really some very beautiful sites. I mean, I've just been blessed with being able to design some of these villages the one in Tanzania, which is just getting started, it faces right on to Mount Kilimanjaro. I mean, you can't beat a better site than that. Others are a little bit like a desert, and then some are kind of up and down the hills. So each one is a challenge, but it's really fun to work with each one.
Now, since you retired from teaching at the university in 99, in the last 6-7 years, how many different countries have you planned villages for?
Well, we have 5 of them operating in 5 countries right now. One is under construction in Zambia. And I'll run down those 10 countries just maybe for interest. For instance, in Ghana and Kenya and Malawi and Nigeria and Uganda, we have our villages underway, and they are in operation. All of them aren't completely built yet. We kind of do it in phases, but they are all going with at least a half a dozen or 8 cottages in each one. Then, we just started construction in Zambia, and then we're about ready. We're getting the walls up around the property in Tanzania and in Ethiopia.
So you've become an international planner of
and, who'd have thunk?
And designer of villages in several different cultures and countries, all in Africa at this point. Now, I want to talk in more detail about that, but let me take just a second to reintroduce our guest for listeners who may have tuned in late. We're talking with an architect whose training and teaching was all at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, who retired in 99 and since then has been working with the Rafiki Foundation. Rafiki is a Swahili word for friend, I just learned. And this foundation was started in this country just in 1985. It's been going on about 20 years. But when did the actual building get started, Chris?
2000 was when we actually started construction in Ghana, and the first one. That was our initial village, and it opened in 2001, and probably is the largest in terms of number of children right now.
Okay. And we're talking with Chris Moyer, and Rosemary Jensen was the woman who began the Rafiki Foundation. Listeners who'd like to ask a question or make a comment on this whole issue of this kind of a cross-cultural, international religious project are invited to call Keeping the Faith. This is a live program usually. Last week was an exception because of Martin Luther King holiday weekend, but we're back live this week. So if you'd like to call, do give us a ring. It's easy. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several lines you can reach by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet, if you're in the continental U.S., we can't take calls from Africa, I'm afraid, or outside of the continental U.S., but 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-WILL. So if you're listening to this program live on the Internet at WILL.UIUC.edu, and then clicking on Keeping on AM 580, you're hearing this live. You may call us, and we're eager to have you join the conversation. We'll be talking about several aspects of this interesting program and getting into some of the controversial questions about missionaries these days later on. But let's now look a little bit more in detail at what you as an architect have to deal with. What have been some of the big challenges, the things that you would really not have expected or had told your students to look out for?
One thing that you do find an awful lot of in Africa is many of these countries, of course, their governments have not been independent as such for that long. There is a fair amount of bureaucracy and ministries of this and ministries of that and approvals required and all sorts of things. Not that we don't have it here, but...
It couldn't be worse than Chicago.
Well, probably not. But that does slow us down and make us a little bit impatient at times. But we do want to, work through those things. And usually a personal contact, and we have people over there who, we're called the country representatives, and they do work very well with the people. So that's one of the problems. The other, of course, is finding appropriate land. And, for instance, in Rwanda, we were offered a piece of land, and when we went out there to look it over to try to fit these 30-some buildings into it, well, there were three major power lines crisscrossing over it,
wow.
Which means you have to have a pretty wide swath that you cannot build under those. And then it was also very steep along several sides, so we just couldn't use that one.
Sure. And does most of the land get donated by the governments, however?
That's what we are doing now, yes. We started out in the first couple actually purchasing land, but we just thought, you know, as much as we are trying to help the countries, that there should be perhaps some land available they could offer to us, and we could use our money in a better way for the buildings and the programs. And so we have generally been able to get land from them. Or occasionally a major church in the country will have been given land years ago, and so they are actually the ones that offer us the land.
Let's look at one of these difficult ethical issues on All Things Considered earlier in the last hour. Randy Cohen, who's the ethicist for The New York Times, was interviewed, as he often is, about an ethical issue. And I know in terms of dealing with governments, you want something from them. For example, land in this case, you want permits to build these buildings. In some cultures, a bribe is expected. That's just the way business is done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What does a religious organization, in this case a Christian group, do when you come into a culture like that? You want to accomplish something good. Do you pay the fixer? Do you pay the bribe? Do you what does it take?
Well, I can tell you what Rafiki does, and we don't pay bribes because we just feel if we started that, then it would just snowball and our money would go very quickly. And so we work through the highest level of government that we can, and that seems to be a very effective way. Rosemary has always tried to involve the first lady of each country, at least informing her what we're doing, and the president as well, if she can get his ear. And that has helped a lot because they have sort of, as they say, greased the skids somewhat when things have gotten bogged down. But we just can't pay those bribes. And you're right, they do, you know, we hear of them, and it's not called that. It's called a fee of some kind.
Sure.
That's what it amounts to.
Or you need to hire a certain person at a certain salary to help facilitate.
That is right. Yes, we've seen that happen.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Now, what about the other religions in these countries that you encounter? When, for example... Rosemary talks to the First Lady or the President. What if they're not interested at all in Christianity? In this case that you're bringing to them, what if they're Muslim?
Yeah.
Or something else.
And that was a concern, especially as we got into Ethiopia. Of course, the farther north you go in Africa, the more Islamic it becomes, and. We were told that it was about half and half, and yet when we got there, we found it really was still a majority was Christian. But a majority was Muslim? No, actually, a majority were Christian.
Okay.
Yeah, because we are right up front with that when we go in and we say we will be teaching the Bible, and we are trying to provide, you know, godly contributors to your country, and that's one of our main plans. And so you offer
a general education, but also a specific, in this case, Christian education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. it's a solid Christian education, no question. And that we use the Bible, for instance, in English class as a basis for, you know, their reading and understanding. So we have had no problem with that whatsoever. I must say, you know, it's great that. That has not stopped. No one has said, "I'm sorry, but we don't want any you Christians in here," or anything like that. They have welcomed us, really, in all those places. There is just so much need. I mean, there are just millions of orphans that are in sub-Saharan Africa that, and they realize it, and they just don't know what to do with all of them. And so our little contribution is just a drop in the bucket, but it's, you get enough drops, and it makes a difference.
Now, when you're dealing with the orphans, they're often there from birth, from very early ages. But you mentioned you also try to have centers in each village for vulnerable teenage boys and girls, up to 60 of them at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they may come in already trained in another religious tradition.
Yes.
What do you do in those cases?
We do not convert them, so to speak, at all. They are allowed to practice their religion. It's just that in our school, we are teaching, the Christian education, and so it's not a it has not been a problem so far, and they are certainly permitted to do that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Chris Moyer, retired architect from the University of Illinois, who since 1999, leaving the teaching here at the university, has been helping design and build whole villages in Africa for orphans and for vulnerable teenagers through the Rafiki Foundation. That's spelled R-A-F-I-K-I, means friend in Swahili. If listeners have questions or comments, please do call us, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And each week on Sunday from 5 to 6, we talk to people from different religious traditions and involved in many different kinds of interesting projects and enterprises. And we give the opportunity as well for listeners to join in the conversation. I see we have a caller or two already waiting to talk with our guest, Chris Moyer. Let's go to line number one on our local line. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, hi, and thank you so much for this program about keeping the faith and all the ethical issues involved. I heard your speaker say that they went to Africa to teach the Bible. And I know that there are different faiths there. My question to you is, and you have addressed this, what do you do when you have a rebellious, vulnerable teenager? How do you teach the Bible to them?
Well, I tell you, these teenagers are so appreciative of being in this situation that we do not see a rebellious kind of an action at all. They have come from the worst possible conditions you can imagine. Most of these girls would have ended up probably on the street in prostitution. We have visited the homes of some of them, and they live virtually in a box somewhere with somebody else, and they may be sold by their uncle to somebody. I mean, it's just unbelievable cases of the conditions they live in. And when they come to the Rafiki village, they tell us this is our safe haven. Mm-hmm. And they just can't wait to get there, and they hate to leave at the end of the day. This is a day school kind of a thing.
Okay.
So far, we haven't had the rebellious teenager. They're just outstanding people, and it's just so much fun to see them, the way they come in, and then the way they leave 3 years later. The change in their life is just unbelievable.
Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing, and I love the term "friends" that you have. Even in Swahili or English, it doesn't matter.
That's right. Well, we are sure trying to be a friend to those folks.
All power to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to another listener on line number two.
Hi, I came in kind of in the middle of your show, so I'm not sure what you've covered so far, but I was concerned when you were talking about adolescents coming. At-risk adolescents coming to your village, and, what if they are Muslim? And how are they going to feel? Do they really have a choice to be able to sit there and not participate in prayer or to stick out of the group of the kids like that? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay. I'm a little bit perhaps outside the loop on exactly how that situation plays out, but I do know that some of those are Muslim, and they have in the morning, for instance, the teenagers do, they have a devotion that starts out, and they read the Bible, and as far as I know, all of the teenagers participate in it, and they really, I just don't think there has been any difficulty with that situation that I know of, and We don't screen them for being only Christian. Many of these teenagers that come in probably don't have a faith at this point. And so we're happy that they're exposed to at least the Christianity. But if they do come in with the Islamic faith, then that's okay.
We're talking with Chris Moyer about his work in Africa designing villages, where Christian education is provided for the students. Are there any rules in some of these countries that restrict the kind of teaching that you can do, or are they so desperate for any kind of help that it's really just completely open?
Oh, actually, they do have some pretty well-established standards for education, and we do work through those agencies. We have a curriculum, of course, that we've developed, and we do approve them, or have them approved by them, because we're hopefully moving these children on into some, and many times into their own schools, and we want them to be able to fit in, of course, when they do it. So we do that, but it's interesting. One country looked at our curriculum and said, "Would you mind if we use that in our schools?" And we said, "Absolutely, you'd be most welcome to it." And that's one of the things we're trying to do, is to provide that sort of service. A Lutheran church over there had a school, and they have asked to be able to use the curriculum as well. So it's a good broad curriculum.
And educators in this country came up with it, or did you have help from people in Africa?
I don't know the total answer to that. We have people in the headquarters here, the home office, that are developing that curriculum, and I'm sure they're calling on people in the field, in certain areas especially, and many of them are teachers or have been teachers. And we also use national teachers over there, and so they have often come, through their educational system in the country.
Chris, I know I'm jumping around a bit, but I'm very curious as to about how you as an architect deal with the infrastructure that it takes to create a village. In some cases, you say it's out away from the capital or away from the urban areas. What do you do about water?
Yeah. Well, that's when you ask about the problems that we have to confront sometimes, that certainly should be included. Water and electricity both are tough ones. Water, we generally have to dig our own well. There are a few cases where there is public water available, but it's very intermittent. It can be off for a week, and so we do dig our own wells, usually have an elevated tank, so that we have a storage capacity. If the power goes off, then we need to be able to provide that water for a while until it gets back on. And so that has generally worked out quite well, and it's usually very good water. We do some treatment in some places where there's a little bit of bacteria, but generally it's quite good water. There are some deep wells, but that's what we do on each village. So it's self-sufficient.
And electricity?
Yeah, electricity is that's kind of one of the criteria that we have to meet when we select a site. Is there electricity available? It would just be it's so expensive to generate our own 24 hours a day. So there has to be adjacent electricity. Now, the Zambia project that's going on, it was about 5 miles away. And so we kind of developed a cooperative thing with several of the landowners along the way and the power company. And so they're running that in to our site now. And then we do have standby generators in every village. It's just so undependable. And you wouldn't believe the power in Liberia. Mm-hmm. There isn't any. Folks have remembered the history of Liberia recently, but they have just been in so many civil wars and strifes lately that they totally destroyed the infrastructure of that country. Mm-hmm. So there is no public electricity, no water in most cases, and so everybody is operating on a private generator, and we are too. But the newly elected president says that's one of her first goals, is to get the power structure back in place.
So would the standby generators be gasoline-powered or propane, or how's that done?
Usually are diesel. We're looking at other energy sources as well as a possibility, palm oil and some other alternate biofuels for diesel. And then some solar things, of course. We haven't done that yet, but that's a pretty likely thing to use in Africa. They got lots of sun over there.
And so, how does that affect a religious organization, a Christian organization in this case, as you plan buildings? How concerned are you with environmental issues?
Well, we certainly want to be a good neighbor to the environment as well. I don't. Do you have anything in mind, particularly environmentally?
Well, I'm just wondering. Can you use? Is it a goal to use solar?
Well, it certainly is, especially for heating hot water. We don't have any essentially any heating and cooling of buildings, although Ghana is a steam bath most of the time, and some of our staff houses have some window air conditioners. We would like to use more solar. Of course, the difficulty is there's a very large upfront cost there, and so we're just sort of trying to work our way into that gradually. And I don't think we're a heavy energy user in most of these villages. Really, it's primarily electrical energy.
We're talking with Chris Moyer, architect from the University of Illinois, retired, who's been working with the Rafiki Foundation in Africa, providing education, Christian education, and services programs for 10 different countries. So far, villages built in 5 of those. We'll get back to Chris in just a minute. Let me take a moment to let listeners know what's coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. We'll have several interesting programs coming up. Next week, we'll be talking with Paul Heiberger about an open university run by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. It's called Communiversity. It's been going on for 30 years or so, and classes will be starting after next week. Various programs are described online at universityymca.org. You can then click on Communiversity. There'll be various the catalogs will be distributed in the various newspapers in the next week or so, and so people can see what classes they might be interested in taking. Some that have always been popular are social dance classes taught by Miss V, who's been doing it for over 25 years at the Y, Miss Aurora Villacorte. She also teaches a class on Philippine cooking that's been quite popular. There are also classes in creative writing, classes in karate for kids taught by Clark Brooks, photography. We have many different classes. You get to hear about those in detail next week from Paul. Coming up in February, Matthew Murray will be reading his poetry. Youssef Estes will be talking about why different Christian leaders, pastors and priests, have been choosing to become Muslim. Interesting conversion direction. That'll be on February 19. On February 26, our guest will be Hillel Hakim, who is an Israeli journalist, talking about the relationship between Christian churches and Israelis in Israel. Those are some of the programs coming up ahead here on Keeping the Faith. I mentioned I'm director of the University Y. The Y does provide support for this all these Keeping the Faith programs. The Y is the oldest Christian, or in fact any religious institution at the university. We've been here 133 years. Interestingly, always up and down Wright Street. We've had buildings. We're in our 5th different building over those years, but still on Wright Street, right across from Lincoln Hall. If you'd be interested in coming to some of our programs, they are open to the public. Friday Forums will start up on February 3rd, and the first Know Your University program is the following week, February 7. William Schultz will be our guest on February 3rd, Friday Forum at noon. He is the executive director of Amnesty International, and he'll be talking about the ruin of human rights as a result of responses to the tragedies of 9/11. So that's a program that should be fascinating, February 3rd at the Y at noon. Free, open to the public. You can pick up a lunch there at the Y Eatery. Wonderful Thai food, food from Thailand. Or bring lunch yourself or simply come and listen to the lecture. There always are time for question and comments from 1 to 1, 1:30. Well, those are some of the programs at the Y. We also are eager for your support, as many organizations are. One way you can support the University Y in its ministry of working with students and others is to donate a vehicle, a car, a truck, even a motorcycle. We've had one motorcycle donated, vans. We had one boat donated, nice little sailboat. Anything with a title, if you donate it, you may take a tax-deductible write-off because of whatever our sale price of it is. And, of course, we're motivated to get a decent price for these things because that's what helps us continue our work at the Y. So if you're interested in that, call me, Steve Shoemaker, 337-1500 during the week, and happy to talk with you about how easy it is to donate a vehicle. Back to Chris Moyer and the Rafiki Foundation. How do you get support for the work you do? It sounds so expensive to build whole villages half a world away.
Yeah, but it's amazing how much we can do for the money that we do have. I mean, for instance, a cottage costs around $36,000, and that's a very permanent building that has four bedrooms and, you know, living room and bathrooms and all that. So we do get a lot for that. But the money comes from private donors, and it can be from someone who is helping to support a orphan by giving $25 or $50 or $100 a month. A month supports them totally for all their needs and education and clothing and the whole thing. There are other donors that give very sizable gifts now and then that may choose to, donate enough money to do a cottage, an entire cottage, or a clinic, or something like that. So it's just an amazing thing to see, and I bet you probably have not seen any billboards or you haven't seen any ads anywhere about the foundation seeking money. It's just word of mouth and God's provision that is doing it. It's an amazing thing.
Rafiki Foundation does have a website. Go to Rafiki, that's R-A-F-I-K-I, -foundation.org. Rafiki, then a little slash, hyphen, not a slash, I'm sorry, a hyphen, half of a dash, and then Rafiki-foundation.org to find out how to make a donation and some of the history of the organization and where various people are speaking around the country about it. Any other words on that, Chris?
Well, I think you'll also see on that website the information on the exchange. These teenage girls and will also, in part of their education, learn an artistic craft that they may produce. In Malawi, they're just doing beautiful wood carvings. And they're doing basketry in some countries, woven materials. There's just some great things they're doing. And those are all brought back to San Antonio, where we have what we call the exchange. And people can buy those things here. It's like a little shop. Or they can order them over the Internet. And all that money then goes right back to support that girls' center. And there's some great things that they have done. It's just amazing to see somebody who has not ever picked up a knife or a chisel in their life, and all of a sudden is creating these beautiful carvings, and so it's really neat.
It sounds like the craft emphasis is following the model of the 10,000 Villages program the Mennonites have done so successfully and helpfully for so long.
Yeah, you see a lot of the same kinds of things in there, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, how often do you get to Africa to actually be on site as these buildings that you've designed are being placed, sited, and built?
That's been a great opportunity. I would have never thought that when I retired that from that point until now I would have been to Africa 14 times, mm-hmm. but that's been the case. It's almost almost three times a year. What we do is There's another gentleman in the office who is a contractor, and he's sort of the facilities manager, and he and I work very closely together. And we will go over at the time when the site is being considered. We will look it over very carefully. We will look at what materials are available, and we will try to get a complete understanding of that site. And I come back and do the site plan for it. And then we will go back after contractors have had a chance to review it, local contractors. And then once we get one established and then they'll get under construction, we'll go back during the time when construction is going on, make sure things are kind of going along the way we had intended. And then the next time usually is at the dedication. But these are whirlwind tours. When you follow Rosemary around, I mean, she's the spryest 75-year-old lady, and I don't think she would care if anybody knew that's how old she was. Spryest 75-year-old lady I've ever seen, and we can't keep up with her on these trips. We'll go to as many as six or seven countries in 1 to 2.5 week period. And we land one day, we have meetings all day the next, and then we go off to another country the next day. And so she really accomplishes a tremendous amount of work in a very short time.
Chris has been referring to Rosemary Jensen, who is the founder and director of the Rafiki Foundation.
Yes.
Chris, when you are designing these buildings, in what way does the different cultures that you encounter in these different countries affect the design? You talked about the materials and mentioned how in Kenya you use stone and field-burned brick in Malawi. I've been to Malawi, and so I've seen some of how the buildings are constructed there, not at Rafiki, but at other places with those brick. But are there different styles? Are there different ways the culture impinges on the design?
From an architect's point of view, of course, we're trying to satisfy the needs of the people using them first. So you kind of work from the plan up. And then I would say the local culture is primarily the materials, although the concept of the village that I've tried to do is when you see it from a distance, it does resemble to a great extent perhaps the African village where there are clusters of houses. We, for instance, cluster these cottages into groups of 3 to 6, and they have a little gazebo that sort of is in the middle of all those, so that's sort of a central
a gathering
point.
Community yeah. place.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And is that typical in most African villages?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, it is. And so, I mean, just for economy's sake, I couldn't start from scratch for every village to be an entirely different style or anything, because we feel that what we're doing is appropriate for what we are trying to accomplish, and we are trying to make them modern, easily maintained buildings. They're not modern in style. I think they fit in appropriately, but it's primarily the materials that the people are used to seeing that would make them feel it was a part of their local culture anyway.
We didn't mention one of the more practical issues. What about sanitation?
Yeah, that's right. It's about always going to be on a septic system, and that's pretty common practice if they even have that in many areas. But we do have septic systems that will handle each building, and then there are what they call soakaways, are essentially they take the effluent and it is then absorbed into the ground. They're very safe and have had no problems from those systems. We're not close enough to tap into any kind of a community, sewage treatment system.
Tell us how one of these buildings looks as you walk up to it. What are the windows like? Doors, screens, open? You're in a tropical climate in some of these countries?
Try to bring in a lot of light. That's one thing to conserve, of course, in terms of need for lighting inside. So we do have a fairly large windows. They do vary from country to country depending on what happens to be the sort of standard practice there. Some are steel casement, and ventilation is a big concern. And, of course, most of these places are the warm climate, so we want to be able to open them up as much as possible. Other places use the glass louvers. We call them sometimes jalousie windows in the States. And that's primarily the type of windows you'll see. And they do have insect screens. And unfortunately, they also have to have an extra little utility there of security bars on most of the buildings, not necessarily all of them, but certainly the housing and the clinics and those kinds of buildings where we have things inside that, you know, you really need to protect. Unfortunately, there have been break-ins or attempted robberies in practically all of the villages, but there have been no injuries, and there have been a few laptops that have been stolen, but these are very resilient people over there, and they just go right on, and we just stiffen up the security a little bit, or get a, you know, a security system, perhaps, something like that.
For some listeners, the very thought of missionaries going from our country to Africa bring back unpleasant memories of missionaries in the past from this country who've gone in the name of Christianity to Africa and other places and tried to impose American culture on the people, as well as this faith, which, although it started in the East, has grown to prominence in the West. How do Rafiki folks deal with those issues?
Well, I would just say right off the top, we are not trying to create little American children. We want them to fit into their own culture. We teach their history and, in many cases, their language, their local language, and plus, of course, math and music and art and the sciences. But we do want them to be contributors to their own country, and we don't feel it would be doing them a favor to try to make them little American children or something. So we are very sensitive to that. And the missionaries, which we don't call them that, that's what they are, but they are referred to as Rafiki Overseas Staff, and they are very dedicated people and just do an amazing amount of work for the good of these little folks that need it so badly.
And in terms of the Christianity that you do teach in the schools, is it open to students who come there, perhaps the teenagers who may be Catholic, even though your organization comes from a Protestant evangelical base?
Yes, and of course there are many Catholics in some of these countries, and they certainly could be coming in, just as we mentioned, the Islamic is prevalent. Why, certainly Catholic too. So I just don't think there has been any difficulty, and again, I'm the architect, and not so much the one
sure.
involved with that. But I've never heard of any difficulties arising out of a conflict of the religion. Certainly.
Mm-hmm. Let me give our phone numbers again. We're down to our last 10 minutes or so, but we can still slip in another caller or two or three. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL to be able to ask a question of our guest, Chris Moyer. Elsewhere, you may call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. So anywhere, it's a long-distance call to Champaign-Urbana, do call us 1-800-222-WILL. And that includes listeners on the Internet at WILL.UIUC.edu. And incidentally, if you tuned in late to this program and would like to have heard what Chris Moyer and I were discussing earlier on, the program will be archived at that same website. So if you have access to the Internet, in a couple of weeks, this program will be up and available, and you can listen to it in its entirety or catch the part that you missed. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs, but I'm eager to have other people ask questions too or make comments. Let's get back to some of the architectural challenges of this kind of a project. When you envision these villages made up of orphans, vulnerable, at-risk teenagers, all together with fairly few adults, it sounds like, how do you protect their safety architecturally? Does that have to come into play? You mentioned the security bars, but and does the grouping help with that?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of the clustering, we have the cottages all in one particular area, and of course we try to keep a good amount of light around at night. And then these homes for the staff are clustered together as well. There is a security fence that goes around the entire site in each village, and then we have several guards that are on duty at all times, and some of them will be roaming, and others will, you know, be at the main gate. So there are security companies also that are on call very close by. So we try to provide those kinds of things, and you know, you can't totally do it, but so far, and we pray for this regularly, that, you know, there would be no children that would be harmed in any way from any kind of incursion. And of course, the people that would come in would be just looking for valuable things, money and that sort of thing. So,
or perhaps some of the female teenagers would be at risk while they're there during the day if they've escaped from prostitution in the cities nearby.
I think it would be very low risk in the village itself. Now, once they leave, you know, we just pray for them constantly that they are going to be able to be back the next day, because, as I mentioned earlier, their conditions are quite difficult for them in some cases. But after they've had this training, it usually brings them up to a much higher level of hope and skill, and they are able to get, we help them get jobs, and so their lives are drastically changed, and if we can just keep them safe during that time, why, we're okay.
Chris, you've talked about how you became involved after your retirement in 1999 from teaching here at the University of Illinois in the School of Architecture. How may other people get involved with the Rafiki Foundation?
Well, there's some good ways. That website you mentioned is a good thing to refer to. They can support an overseas staff person. We have many people there in town that actually are contributing towards our staff. Our staff raise their own funds. They're not paid by Rafiki, so they raise contributions to be over there. Or the people could become a staff person themselves. We would, you know, we always need, I think, as it says in the Bible, you know, the harvest is plenty, but the workers are few, and it takes about, on a full village, about 20 of these staff members, and now most of them right now are in the 10 to 12 range as they are building up in size. People can go on a short-term mission, which is very good. My wife, Sandy, and some of her friends have gone on several over there and worked in the orphanages or worked with the girls in the teenage center, and that's about a two-week situation. There are groups around that we call Rafiki prayer groups. They're essentially a group that supports the work of Rafiki by meeting together in a town and you know, being brought up to date on what's going on. They pray for any special needs. They're sometimes exposed to the products that are available and that sort of thing. There's one in Champaign there at Jamie and Amy Chesser's, and they would always be glad to have folks join in there. Or you could just, they can just donate to the fund that would help to build the facilities. Or we think is kind of a neat thing is to just to help support an orphan by, you know, contributing on a monthly basis for one of these little guys or girls.
I want to ask you what satisfactions you've gained from your affiliation with this project since your retirement. I mean, beyond, you know, the very high architectural fees that, of course, you charge.
Zero. that's just the greatest thing. I mean, you know, it is. There's a certain, as an architect, there's a great amount of pleasure in designing a building and seeing it built when you're done, and you can stand back and take a certain amount of pride in it. But if it's an empty building, it's not doing anybody any good. And when you visit, and I am able to go back to these villages, and there are kids running in and out of those cottages, and they're eating in the dining hall, and all of that's going on, that's when it really comes home, is when you get the greatest amount of satisfaction to realize that these kids' lives are being changed, and not just by the buildings, but by the whole operation, but it's just a part of that that it's really been a privilege to be a part of.
And what have been the frustrations?
I can't think of too many frustrations. Mm-hmm. I guess one of our ongoing concerns is, surprisingly enough, being able to get enough orphans, and it's part of the bureaucracy thing. We do work through social service agencies, and you would think that they would be knocking down our doors to bring the orphans to us, but they are super cautious sometimes, or they don't want to institutionalize the child, you know, and yet we have these home situations that we're trying to create. So that's probably at the moment the frustration. Other than that, it would be hard for me to come up with something that I could look at and say, that's a tough part. I did want to mention one other thing, that these 10 villages that we've been talking about in those 10 countries is really one-tenth of what we hope to do eventually. Around each of those, we're planning right now satellite villages, which would be slightly smaller and would be eventually run by the country or the large denomination of whatever that might be of the church. And then around those would be what we call Rafiki homes, where a widow and perhaps she has two or three children would take on another five or six children, and we would train her and pay for their food. So when you get done at any one point, and when this is all filled out, we could be affecting almost 36,000 children and teenagers through this program. We're just really excited about that.
We've been talking on Keeping the Faith today with Chris Moyer, who with his wife Sandy have been local Champaign-Urbana residents for most of their lives. And Chris taught at the School of Architecture at the University for 15 years after himself being a graduate of both advanced degrees and a bachelor's degree from this university. We've been talking about his involvement with the Rafiki Foundation, and Chris, do want to thank you for being on the program, and I do also thank those who called in with comments or questions. The Rafiki Foundation does provide Christian education for students in 10 different countries in Africa eventually by building villages there where schools and safe havens can be for young children up through teenage years. People who'd like more information or would like to contribute may check out the website, rafiki-foundation.org. That's rafiki-foundation.org. If you don't have access to the internet, there is a phone number in San Antonio, 210-244-2600. That's 210-244-2600. Coming up next week here on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Paul Heiberger, talking about an open university called Come University, provided by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Ice is amazing stuff. A few cubes in a glass and you have a refreshing drink. A light glaze on a highway and you have a tragedy waiting to happen. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, a visit with a woman who knows pretty much all there is to know about ice. And where there's ice, there's often snow, so we'll talk about avalanches. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Lincoln Diagnostics Incorporated, Decatur; Starlight Software Systems Incorporated, Normal; and the Rainey Foundation in Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-20s and light winds. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the lower 40s and northwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.